What I'm going to do is go through three sort of philosophical ideas and try to trace them historically, see how they develop over time, and then talk about a series of ideas about health that seem to follow along on the same kind of path and seem to be quite influenced by these other general ideas. So it's sort of like an exploration of a series of ideas and how they fit together. Okay, this way. And the three ideas that I'm going to talk about are ideas about the underlying nature of the world, whether the world is chaotic or ordered, and the connection between chaos and order in how people thought about the world, how those ideas have changed in time. The second idea is about how humans relate to nature and how those ideas have changed over time. And finally, the idea about how we know who we are, the notion of ourself. How do we understand ourselves, our self-identity in time, and how that idea has changed over time. And then relate those three ideas and the changes in those ideas to how our ideas of health have changed. So the first idea is about order and chaos. And it's very interesting that I'm going to go through all of these steps in it, looking at creation myths, ancient Greek philosophy, a little bit about the medievals, the period of the scientific revolution with Descartes and Francis Bacon, people like that, and then talking about the changes in the scientific revolution, what's happened since then, about the notions of the relationship between order and stability. So, I mean, we're all aware of the fact that in the Bible, God creates the world out of chaos, that it's order coming from disorder. But it's not just the Judeo-Christian tradition that has that. Most cultures have the notion that there is a being, a God of some kind, or a series of forces of some kind that create order out of chaos, that creation myths are always about order out of chaos. And in many of these creation myths, the question about the return of chaos is part of the story. It's how do order and chaos relate in the world, and how does that happen, is a big, big issue that comes in most primitive societies that are beginning to think about the beginnings or the idea that order has begun to come out of chaos. It's interesting that even in ancient Greece, the notion of whether the world around us was ordered or chaotic remained an issue. So people like Heraclitus, the ancient Greek philosopher, thought that the world was always changing, that there was no stability in the world, that the world was in some ways quite chaotic and disordered, and talked about, the famous line from Heraclitus is, "You can't step in the same river twice." And my friend Jerry Cohn, who's a philosopher in England, said, "Of course you can. You put your foot in the river, and then you run down the river, you put it in again, and you step in." No. And of course, there were other philosophers in ancient Greece who said, "Well, there's no change. There's no change in the world at all. The real world doesn't change at all, and change is almost impossible." And to a certain extent, those issues were discussed by Plato, who wanted to bring the two ideas together and shifts it actually from a statement about the world to a statement about knowledge. And he says that we can know things if they're not changing. We can't know them if they're changing all the time. So the world around us, the physical world, is a world which is very much not in order. It's very much full of change. And so our knowledge doesn't come from that world. But we do know things. And so our knowledge must come from a world where things don't change. And so there must be a world that doesn't change, a world of reality. And so he had the notion of almost two different worlds. One, the world around us, the world of becoming. And the other one, the world of being, as he called it. And there's a very famous picture by Raphael, which has Plato pointing up to the stars and sort of saying, that's where the real world is, and this world around us isn't real. And Aristotle then has the view, has his hand out, and says, this is the world that's real, and we have to understand this world. So Aristotle believed that the world around us probably had an underlying order. He thought that the world around us was understandable, that there were stable elements in it. There was enough in it so that you could know things about the world around us, and developed a picture of that world in much of his writing. So he had a description of physics, he had a description of a metaphysics, he had an account of various pictures of beginnings of biology, beginnings of many of the sciences that we have today, thinking about them, looking at them, doing observation, and developing certain kinds of theoretical structures around them that were, for a very long time, the stable way in which people try to understand the world. So if you want to think about science lasting for a long time, Aristotelian physics was pretty much the physics of record that lasted from I'd say 400 BC kind of time to 400 to 1400 AD. So it's 2,000 years, a relatively stable theoretical frame around which other theories began to grow. And the connection then between science and other things is a really important connection, that the way in which people think about the world is the way they think about other things as well. So there are interactions between how we think about the world and the values that we have, what we think of as truth, how we gain knowledge, how we use knowledge, and so on. And it's important to recognize that, and I'll come back to that, because you'll see that that is some of the things, one of the ways of thinking about how these ideas also impact on how we think about things like health. In medieval physics took on Aristotelian physics in the end, and added the role of an active god, an active creator, which Aristotle really didn't have, so that the order and disorder in the world were related to divine will, as well as to the way in which the structure is there. But there is an order, but it's an order that's understandable to God. It's not necessarily understandable to man. There are real limitations to human understanding of these, of what the realities are around us. And he introduces, and in the medieval time, Aristotle introduces the idea that there are ends to things, that there is that one of the causes, one of the ways of thinking about causality is thinking about the purpose of something. So, for example, the purpose of an acorn is to become an oak tree. Right, and the acorn, so the notion that there are ends and objectives of things is part of their nature and part of our understanding of their causes. And the new ways in which the medievals thought about these ends was to think about God's cause, the ends that God wanted for particular objects. So the way in which the medievals would look at things would think about them as, for example, the reason that a swan is white is to teach us about purity. To teach us about purity of soul and to connect those ideas with this broader picture of reality that the medievals had in their religion. So there were, and the sources of knowledge at the time of the medievals included not only the observation and the historical documents that came down from the ancients, but also revelation and also scripture. So you added more sources of knowledge. And the idea was, one of the things that they believed, interestingly, very different from our time, is they believed that in olden times people knew more than they did. And there was a loss of knowledge over time, that in fact there had been a deterioration of knowledge, and what we had to do is try to regain some of the knowledge that had been lost. In the medieval period, the late medieval, early Renaissance period, people began to attack Aristotle. And they attacked Aristotle because they began to look at physics differently. So, for example, Copernicus introduces the heliocentric, picture of the heliocentric solar system rather than a geocentric one. And that's a very deep attack on Aristotle. It really changes things. Galileo, you know, attacks his theory of how bodies fall, that you don't add bodies up, and there has to be another way of looking at gravity. And there were tremendous attacks on teleology, the idea that things have purposes. So you started to get attacks on the very foundations of Aristotelian thinking at that time. And there were many reasons for this. Everything from the introduction of the printing press to the discovery of America. And there was new thinking going on, and people were beginning to push at old ways of thinking. Bacon said that what you really had to do was you had to get rid of a lot of the old thinking. You had to get rid of the ways in which we thought about things that were mistaken, that led us into mistakes. That there were sort of things that were inherent in our nature that led us to look at the world in certain ways that were false. There were sometimes subjective attitudes that we had that we had to overcome in order to get to better pictures of the truth. We had to get rid of that sometimes language would mislead us. And these are the idols that Bacon talks about. And he talks about a method of gathering information and of testing things, beginning to test things in order to find out whether or not you could get some kind of truth that was objective and different than the old one. And Bacon becomes the inspiration for the beginnings of the Royal Society and the rise of what we now call modern science. Right? When the Royal Society began, the picture of the history of the Royal Society that came out just after it began was a picture of Bacon. Bacon as the source of these ideas and the source of that beginning of that revolution. In that period, Descartes began to look at the world now no longer in a teleological way, no longer looking for ends, and no longer looking at it in an Aristotelian way. So huge break with the past. And he begins to think about the world as mechanical and human beings as mechanical. So he sees human beings as mechanisms. He thinks that even if human beings didn't have, the mental aspect of human beings was separated, that the physical aspects of human beings could continue, that we were basically machines with minds. And he thinks of animals as mechanical, and he thinks of the universe as mechanical, so the world is mechanical. And of course, that picture of the universe as mechanism, or the solar system as mechanical, is something that Newton takes up, develops a theory of gravity, that's a different one than Aristotle's, and begins to talk about trying to show how the solar system functions as a mechanism, and tries to prove what has been called the problem that he set was the problem of showing the stability of the solar system. He believes that the theory of gravity applies to everything from the tiniest objects to the largest astronomical objects. So the three laws of motion that Newton introduces are laws that apply to everything in the world, right? They're universal laws. So what he starts is that process of looking at the solar system in a certain kind of way. It's interesting that there was a debate that happened at the time of Newton between Newton and Leibniz, and it's described in a series of letters between Leibniz and really Newton's representative, this guy Clark, the Clark-Leibniz debate. And what the picture that Newton had of the world was that the solar system was built by God. And it was clockwork, but it was like a real clock. So God would have to come in and adjust it every once in a while, fix the dial, wind it up, make sure that everything was working right, put in a little bit of oil, do things like that. So God had a role as the caretaker of a real clockwork solar system. Leibniz believed that if God created the solar system, then he would have created a perfect solar system that never needed any kind of intervention. Right, so that it would be a self-running machine, an eternal machine. And those two views, the struggle between those two views became a very important struggle at the time. Newton was very, very religious and believed that there was a God. The fear was that if you took God out of the solar system, that there would be, that might very well lead to atheism. And his colleagues, the people he worked with in the Royal Society, were also in that way. Many of them were very religious. So Boyle also feared at the end of his life that this new science might lead to a kind of atheism. And the guy who brought it to that point was a man whose name was Simon Laplace. I don't know if you've heard of him. But Simon Laplace was a late 18th, early 19th century French mathematician. He's the man who did very early census in France, did a lot of demography, did a lot of studies of hospitals. But his big book is a book called Celestial Mechanics. He was a young genius, very much like Newton, and he saw in his mind, he thought that what he was going to do was complete Newton's work. He was going to prove the stability of the solar system, and he was going to prove that the solar system worked on a Leibnizian model, that you could do that. So he said that planets would change the way in which they moved around the sun over a period of 10,000 years. And he thought that what he could do is he could get a series of formulae eventually that would prove that the solar system was completely stable over that period of time. And that if you had a picture of the solar system at one instant in time, and you understood the Laplacian formulae, then you could deduce where every element in the solar system would be all the way into the future and all the way back to the beginning of time. Okay? Now that model, Laplace thought, would not only work for the solar system, but it might work for everything. And so as a very young man, he had the idea that if there were a being who understood all the laws of nature and had a picture of the world, the universe, at one instant in time, then he would be able to deduce everything that had ever happened from that and everything that would happen in the future. And that being is called Laplace's demon, and he writes about it. And that long thing is Laplace's description of that, a description that he wrote when he was in his 20s. That description, I think, is at the core of our belief about the world. That one aspect of us, of most of us, is that we believe something like that. That if only we had all the laws right, and if only we had all the information, then we could figure everything out. This is an aside. There are two. Napoleon, when Laplace came to Paris, he studied with a man by the name of Lagrange, and Lagrange got him a job at the military academy, the Académie Militaire, and Napoleon was there. And apparently, whether it's true or not isn't clear, but Napoleon was there at the same time that Laplace taught, and there's some discussion about whether or not they actually had contact at that time. But certainly when Laplace wrote his Celestial Mechanics, Napoleon was in power, and he knew Napoleon, he knew Laplace. And he came to Laplace and he said, look, I've read your book, because Laplace's book was accessible. I've read your book, but I see in it there's no mention of God. And Laplace is said to have replied, God is an unnecessary hypothesis. So you have that, you know, that change. The second thing that happened was that he Napoleon appointed Laplace as the Minister of the Interior, and he fired him after 6 weeks. And the quote is the one that's up on the screen. That what he wanted to do was to reduce everything down to the atomic elements, find out what the laws were, and apply them. Right, and of course, it didn't work. So I think that this is the argument against Frederick Taylor that happened 100 years before Taylor ever existed, right? So it's an interesting notion that here, that though this worked in the world, maybe, it certainly didn't work in the ministry. Poincaré, at the end of the 19th century, showed that when you have three bodies in space that have gravitational forces, you can't have a single formula that's going to tell you where they all are at the same time. Okay, and so the three-body problem, which is a mathematical problem related to gravitation, suggests that you can't do that. So that it's not just that we haven't found the formula yet. It's that there is no formula that you can find because of the way in which three bodies interact. Later, there's a man by the name of Jack Wisdom who, in the 1980s, built a computer that took into account a large number of variables, and he and his colleague calculated the paths of the outer planets and found that there were chaotic aspects to the path of one planet, of Pluto, at that time. That was 1988. What they did was they took into account, instead of the number of variables that Laplace did, they took into account a much larger number of variables and did a series of calculations for each state. Right, and found that it would become chaotic after a while. And Jacques Lascar in 1989 built an even more powerful computer and ran out doing the numerical integration of places in the solar system, taking into account 150,000 variables, doing the test over time, discovered that the universe became chaotic. The world, the solar system, was unstable over a period of 200 million years. So you go from the notion that there is a distinction between order and chaos. And of course, Ilya Prigogine, who's one of the founders of European complexity theory, says that no matter how many variables you can know variables all the way out, you're not going to be able to make predictions forever. And that. So this is a very powerful attack on the picture that Laplace has. It's very hard for us to assimilate what that means. We think that we understand what that means, but deep down, we think if only we had more information, and if only we had the formulae, we'd be able to do this. So it's very hard to assimilate that we can't do it. Okay? And it seems as if there is more and more evidence that we can't do it. But we don't understand exactly what that means, I think. We know that there are lots of non-forecastable phenomena now, and we have mathematical proof that tells us that there are things that are not forecastable. Everything from the stock market to the weather to the next drip of the faucet. So it's not simply that we don't have enough information and that we don't have the formulae right. It's that, given the nature of these phenomena, there is no way to get the formulae. And it's not just a matter of not having enough information or not getting the formulae right. That's the hard thing for us to assimilate. Okay, so that's the first thing. So you go from the notion that everything is chaotic to it's being ordered by a divine being, to the notion that the world is basically ordered, to the notion that, well, looks like there's an interaction between order and chaos happening all the time. That seems to be the root of that idea. That's how it seems to go. The second idea we'll trace in the same kind of way. We'll go from ancient times to modern times and look at the changes in the idea. How am I doing for time? Okay. So in pagan societies, everything has spirits associated with it. The world is alive. Rocks are alive, mountains are alive, trees are alive, everything is alive. Everything has a soul. We were talking before about astrology. What isn't widely known is that even though we have astrology today, of course, but some people believe in astrology today, but it's thought to be a pseudoscience. But in fact, up until the 5th century or the 6th century, people built temples to the stars, thinking that the planets around the world were gods. Not that they were represented gods, but that they were gods. That's where the gods were, and you saw them in the night sky. This is the joke that goes with that is two young Canadian girls are sitting and talking, and one says, what's further, Vancouver or the moon? And the second one says, hello, you can see the moon. Aristotle made a distinction between different kinds of living things. I mean, he said that that there were different kinds of souls. So there were vegetative souls, animative souls, and rational souls, and distinguished human beings from the others on the basis of the rational souls. But Aristotle really thought that that only human beings had self-conscious lives. What's interesting? So the medievals then began to take human beings and make them even more distinct from the rest of the world, because human beings were divine creations, and there's a kind of hierarchy of being that the medievals saw. Oh, look at that! It doesn't come out on the screen. Isn't that interesting? I think there's not enough memory in this computer or something. That's the great chain of being. The great chain of being. There you go. The great chain of being, it goes from, it has all these different aspects of the world are all hierarchical. So there's a hierarchy of minerals, a hierarchy of animals, a hierarchy of trees, a hierarchy of living things. At the top of the hierarchy of mortal living things are human beings. They're just below angels. So angels go above the line, human beings go below the line. And human beings actually cross over a little bit because of their rationality and because of the possibility that their souls are immortal, right? So they can cross the line. When you look at that picture, it's very interesting that today, in our minds, what we do is we see a picture of a lion, and you see a picture of the sun, and it's gold. And it doesn't matter what color you make it, it's still the sense that the lion, the sun, and gold all go together. And the sun is in the hierarchy of planets and is the highest planet, and the purest. The lion is the king of the animals. And gold is the king of the metals. It's the highest metal. So that notion of hierarchy and the hierarchy of these ideas is very, very deep in our own psyches. It's not something that's accidental. It has a very long history and a very powerful history. And that kind of symbol is one that sits with us. It's one that we all recognize and recognize almost immediately. Think about it. That we think in that way so much, and it's so deep in our culture. Bacon talks about the discovery of different kinds of truths, luciferous ones that shed light on things, and fructiferous ones that allow us, practical application, allow us to gain control over nature. And there are different views of Bacon now. It used to be, before the 1960s, Bacon was thought of as the fact that science was going to allow us to exploit nature, and to gain power over nature and to gain control over nature. And since the 1950s and 1960s, Bacon scholarship has changed, and now Bacon is thought to be a lot more environmentally sound. Right? But certainly Bacon believes that what science will do is give you a sense of control over nature. I mean, he begins that idea, and the idea comes doesn't only come from him, but he believes that that's one of the things that science will do. And Hobbes, who knew Bacon personally, you know, we don't know, these guys actually contacted each other, right? Hobbes used to go for walks with Bacon, and Bacon really liked Hobbes because Hobbes understood what he was saying. And Hobbes would write down Bacon's thoughts as they walked along the garden. I mean, that kind of stuff, as a young man. So Hobbes' idea is that the world is a jungle, right? That in the state of nature, it's a jungle. That there are no rules, that things are chaotic, that everything is uncontrolled, everything is dangerous, everything is wild, right? It looks like, right, like that picture. And the idea was that science would tame nature, right? That science would tame nature, and so that in the future you get rid of the jungles, you get rid of the swamps, you drain the swamps, you get rid of the jungles, you have plantations and zoos and things like that. Everything is civilized then, and that we would domesticate the world. We began huge engineering projects at that time because of scientific capacity. In the 19th century, this was a very optimistic picture of the world that science was going to do. And I think that picture lasted until the middle of the 20th century. I mean, a lot of U.S. Army engineering projects came up, that were like that. The Suez Canal is a function of this, a lot cleaning up things and doing very, very large projects like that. In the middle of the 20th century, Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring. In the United States, this made a huge difference, and I think it made a difference here too. I think that people began to change their attitude, and I think that we have very different attitudes. So that the notion that within a lifetime, very serious and deep attitudes can change, you know, is something that people don't think that it might take longer than that. But in fact, this is an idea that has changed within many people's lifetime in the last 50 years. That a lot of the things that had to do with these interferences, the notion that one could control nature, the notion that science was going to provide the answer to all the questions about nature has really, I think, gradually eroded, and that we now think that we have to live in accord with nature, in the same way as the medievals thought they had to. We have to have respect for nature, you have to have respect for God's creatures, you have to understand that you are part of nature and not simply the master of nature. We don't sit in that place in the great chain of being anymore. And this has a lot to do with, there's not one thing, it wasn't just Rachel Carson that changed it. There are lots of other influences on this. But certainly, the publication of the book Silent Spring marked a major change in people's attitudes to these things. So now, that's the way we see the jungle, right? That it's full of complex patterns and has a delicate order, fragile relationships, it's exotic and it's free. So, and in fact, what's interesting is that we go from one picture to the other, and we actually hold both of those views at the same time. And they're not contradictory. And in a way, that's when you want to talk about having a more complex understanding of things, that's the way in which this pendulum swings back. So the cycle, both thinking about there's a world that's chaotic, God orders it, the world is orderly, and then we have a notion of there's an interaction between order and chaos. That's a richer picture of the world. The same thing happens here. We have a richer and more complex picture of the relationship between humans and nature. The third idea is about self-identity, understanding who you are, and go through the same thing again. That in primitive societies, the way people understood themselves was they understood themselves by their place in a kinship group. I am somebody would be somebody's sister or somebody's wife or somebody's daughter and somebody else's cousin, that those kinds of relationships become the way in which you understand who you are. You understand who you are in relation to other people. And some of these kinship structures are very, very complex and very hard to decipher, in fact. And many anthropologists spend years deciphering how people identify themselves, and the identification can be relatively complex. For Aristotle, when you read Aristotle, a good way of reading Aristotle is to understand that Aristotle saw individuals as part of a society. And when he talks about the state, he talks about the elements of the state are individual people. So the state is the big thing, and individuals form part of it. The notion, Aristotle's notion of happiness and a good life is really talking about how what is not acontextual. It's always as being part of society, being part of the society that one lives in. So being a good person for Aristotle had a great deal to do with playing out one's role as a citizen, playing out one's role in the society, whatever that role was. And in that way depends on place and also about how one uses that place, obviously. In the medieval period, there are books now being written that the notion of the independent self really begins in the late medieval period. What really people are talking about is that the extent to which personal salvation is a function of individual action. And really it comes from that notion that in the late medieval period, people begin to differentiate themselves from others in a more extreme way, is the argument. And there's an interesting book written about the development of the sense of self in the late medieval period. That your identity then becomes distinct from the political context and your family and so on. In the Renaissance and the Reformation, people now begin to have the right to even pray individually, for example, and that so grows even stronger. And Descartes, who begins to separate body and mind in this very extreme way, starts to get the notion that the idea of self becomes mental. That who I am is mental. It's not physical. It's just what I think of. And if you take that famous part of the meditations where he says, cogito ergo sum, it's only thinking that makes me who I am. And in fact, it's by thinking that I know who I am. And it becomes obvious, logically obvious, supposedly, according to Descartes, that knowing myself or knowing who I am is purely a mental phenomenon. And then I have to prove the existence of the physical world. Right? So you have the withdrawal of the self from being entirely external to being almost entirely internal on this swing of the pendulum. And what's been happening since then is that we've been drawing back. So current philosophers in the last century began to talk about the fact that you can't separate the body and the mind in the same way that Descartes did. That you have to start to think about people in their context. That the idea of thinking has to be associated with language, which has to be associated with other people, and has to be associated with where you are and what that context that you find yourself in. So people like Gilbert Ryle and G.E. Moore and Ludwig Wittgenstein all were arguing against the Cartesian picture of that separation and the notion of self as being somehow a disembodied spirit inside the body. And of course that goes together with current theories about linguistics and the notion of the connection between the self and other environments. And understanding who we are in the context of our culture, and also developmental theories talk about the importance of the external impacts on development, both neural development and personality development. So the brain only develops in certain kinds of ways with certain kinds of input from the outside world, for example, that kind of stuff. So if you look at the three big ideas, what you see is a similar pattern of change that happens in these three ideas. That they go to a kind of mechanistic account and a distinction between humans and the rest of the world, the special nature of human beings, to going back to older views, but to a richer and different picture of these interactions that we now have than people had at the beginning. So it's an interesting kind of pendulum swing that happens where things do change, and they change and become more complex, but we take in some of the older ideas as well. Well, let's talk about health, given that I only have 2 minutes. But I'm going to go longer, I think. I think I'm going to go a bit longer. So in health, the thing that's interesting is that the oldest ideas of health have to do with spirits inhabiting the body. And the job of the doctor was to get rid of the spirits. And this is true of many primitive societies, is to assuage the spirits or to get rid of the evil spirits or to do something like that. So, and that was certainly true in the Mesopotamian this is the Mesopotamian medical books, right, that we have that picture. Aristotle takes it that connects health as health for Aristotle as a resource. It's one of the resources that allow you to lead a good life. It's not an end in itself for Aristotle. It's a resource for the good life. So if you're very, very ill, you can't have a good life. right? Because you're ill and you're in pain, that's not a good life. And the test of a good life is that you have the resources for living it, and health is one of them. And he also talks and relates this back to the theory of order and chaos, right? That an imbalance of different elements in the body is what illness is, and the objective of cure is to rebalance things, and that's the general view that he has. He was the son of a doctor. He uses health as an example quite a lot, but he doesn't talk about it directly very much. The guy who does do that is Galen. And the thing that's true about Galen is that Galen's medical theories, like Aristotle's, Galen was born in the year 200. So his medical theories, which came from Aristotle, lasted also for a very long period of time. Right? And what it does is he integrates his medical theory with the theory of the world, with the seasons, with the ages of man, with organs, with humors, with personality. So it all fits together, right? You just keep on adding layers to this. This picture, versions of this picture, have appeared in medical books for almost 2,000 years. Right? They still appear in medical books. Like when you study medicine now, you do a little bit of history of medicine, you always have that picture. It was taken seriously and used in medicine up until the year 1800. And the idea is that all of these things interact. The four humors interact with each other, they interact with personality, they interact with lifestyle, they interact with the fluids in the body, and they go every which way. It's not a one-way thing. It's not that you change the fluids. If you get more black bile, you will become angry. If you become angry, you will get more black bile. It's both ways. Interactive, bidirectional. If you want to cure anger, one of the ways of doing it is to get some black bile out of your body. Another way of doing it is to change your lifestyle. So the notion of all of these different ways of intervening is Galenic. That is, it's, and Galen, the thing that's really interesting is in these books they talk about, I've been looking at a lot of Galenic medicine. One of the things that they have is Galen's diet. He has a diet, like Dr. Atkins. And modern nutritionists sort of go through Galen's diet and say, if you live on Galen's diet for 6 months, you'll die. Because it's so nutritionally unsound, is what they say. So it's really interesting that nobody kept a diet as far back as Galen. Because people weren't dying on Galen's diet, right? So, dietary regimens are there to be broken. Medieval health continues the Galenic tradition, but adds God. Same thing, adds God. So that God also is in there as a vengeful being who sort of can make you sick. But the thing that's added in the medieval period, I think, to the lexicon of health, sense of health. So Galen's view of health is balanced humors. Keeping the humors in balance. If you have balanced humors, you're healthy. If you don't, you're not healthy. The medieval period had a notion of health in paradise, the Garden of Eden picture of health. And that's the picture that there was no pain, no illness, no aging. Right? That happened to Adam and Eve until the fall. I find it really interesting that the WHO definition is the same as the definition for the Garden of Eden. Right? A complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being. So there's a view of paradise in there. Right? I mean, according to that definition, I don't think that there's anyone in this room who's healthy. Well, nobody's standing up. I mean, you know, think about it, right? So it also is a notion of a goal, or the idea that somehow we'll try to regain this paradise in one way or another. And of course, that's one of the objectives. Paracelsus begins the attack. Paracelsus, Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. So nice to say it. He burns Galen's books in the town square. I mean, these are the famous stories about Paracelsus. An itinerant physician gets kicked out of one town after another. Does alchemy. The picture that he has of health is a picture that's come down to the modern period. He's been rehabilitated, in modern history of medicine as one of the most important influences on modern medicine, because he has the picture of the body as a kind of chemical retort. With the proper chemicals and the proper processes in the body, that's when you have health. That's the picture that he has. And he believes that the interesting processes in the body are processes of digestion and fermentation, right? The processes that have interested many physicians and many medical scientists for the period from Paracelsus on. So he has all kinds of ideas about cures, and many of his cures are correct. So, for example, for anemia, you take iron, says Paracelsus. His reasoning, however, is different. So why take iron for anemia, according to Paracelsus? Well, you take iron because anemia is a disease of the blood. Blood is red. Mars is red. Mars is the god of war, right? And Mars is associated with becoming stronger. And iron is related to war. And so what you do is you take iron for anemia. Now it works, right? So, but the reasoning is sort of slightly different. So he uses the argument by analogy as well as other things in order to get to the end. But also, there are ways in which he is also taking experiential material and all of that. But his argument is a very interesting and different one. Descartes, again, goes back to the human body as a machine. And one of the things that isn't well known about Descartes is that in the Meditations, he has that sentence at the bottom is there. The preservation of health has always been the principal end of my studies. That he thought that he was doing his philosophy so that he could come to a science of medicine that was as certain as geometry. That's what he was after. And it's not noticed by philosophers. It's only noticed by crazy people like me who read it for different reasons, right? So if you're looking for it, you find it. But that's what he actually is doing. That's the objective. That's what he's after. That's the practical application of Descartes' philosophy. Medicine. Robert Boyle brings together Paracelsus and Descartes and argues for a corpuscular mechanical account of the world as well as of health. And Robert Boyle, much of what Robert Boyle did was in health. And in fact, he took almost no honors in his life. He wouldn't agree to become the president of the Royal Society, but he did agree to accept an honorary title as a physician. So his interest is medical. He had a very powerful medical interest in this stuff, and a very powerful interest in health. In fact, I think that he was the medical research council of his time. He funded it himself. He was the son of the richest man in England. So this picture of bringing together the Paracelsian view and the Cartesian view of the body now, the Cartesian view of the body is if that health would be having a smoothly running machine, having a chemical plant that functioned well, and having a smoothly running machine is at the essence of a picture of health that comes down from that tradition and becomes the program for medicine for 300 years. Built by people like Sydenham, the sanitarians in the 19th century, the germ theorists in the later 19th century. I think the germ theorists were the high point of that tradition. So people like Koch and Pasteur, who began to understand fermentation, who began to understand, could identify the diseases, could find their causes, could find their cures, and that picture of disease, the picture of acute onset diseases that led to the epidemics, the identification of them and the cure of them, followed this model. It showed the success and the wonderful possibilities inherent in the chemical mechanical model of the body. It led to great successes, enormous successes, at the hands of people like Koch and Pasteur, and they were the beginnings, the founders, if you like, of what we call modern medicine. What happened was that public health and all of these things were going to would work by hygiene, said the sanitarians. And it became clear that the people began to suffer from medically treatable diseases, and so you had the arguments for publicly funded healthcare, which happened in the late 19th century. And of course the NHS appeared only 50 years after these arguments began. That's about the time it takes for an idea to sink in. 50 years is about right. Okay, so be patient. So. And of course, one of the things that they promised when they had the NHS was that if we could treat people who had medically treatable conditions, we would have a healthier population and demand would go down. Instead, it went up. So the success of the chemical mechanical model really raised demand. Because there was more that you could do. And then what began to happen was that there was limitations of the approach began to become evident, so that some disease didn't seem to follow the model. That the 30-year war on cancer in the United States, they've spent over $100 billion to find the cure for cancer. And they haven't succeeded. To a certain extent, that's because there was a misconstrual of what the nature of the disease was. It's not one disease, it's many. It doesn't have a single cause, it has multiple causes. It doesn't respond to a single treatment, there are multiple treatments. So it's not like the old diseases. It has to be thought of in a different way. And the reconceptualization of these diseases is something that we're just going through right now. That's what's happening. And someone said that what researchers are doing is they're trying to understand it. It's sort of like the way in which they're approaching cancer is sort of like trying to understand an epidemic of shooting by spending millions of dollars trying to figure out how gun triggers work. Right. I said it. I think it's terrific. Do you think it's a good one? In the late 70s, Thomas McEwen, I think he's Scottish. Do you know about this guy? You do. You do. Yeah. And you know where he was really influential? In Canada. He was the guy who influenced the writing of the Lalonde Report in Canada. And the notion is that health doesn't come by the smooth running of machine or the good running of the chemical retort. It's that there are other things that you have to think about. And the Lalonde Report talks about these four major influences on health. And that's what McEwen introduces, the notion of influences on health, which later become determinants of health, which later become the basis for what modern health promotion. So these are the four determinants at the time of the Lalonde Report, the environment, lifestyle, human biology, and healthcare organization. And the Black Report in 1980 sort of expands this. I'm going really over time now, eh? It's okay? Increases the number of determinants of health, but starts to correlate health with socioeconomic status, which is a big issue in Britain. And they start to have these pictures looking at epidemiologically at these various boxes that interact in a causal way. So still, this turns out to be a bigger picture mechanical model, but it's still a mechanical model looking at it in population terms. Adding these factors like environment, lifestyle, to human biology. Okay. The picture becomes more complicated with many more boxes, looking at many more variables. And this comes from a Canadian organization called CHEPA that tries to model health in these kinds of terms. So those are the four metaphors. The four humors, the Garden of Eden, the chemical processor, the machine. And you have them going through. And where we are now is that the metaphor seems to be changing, but we don't know where it's going. Okay? That's the point of this whole talk, that we have these big ideas that change. They have an impact on how we think about health. The big ideas have changed, but our idea of health the new idea of health is still very, very unclear. Still very unclear. And what I'm going to try to do is to give you this another unclear picture of it. Not a very clear picture, but one that I've been working on for 10 years. It's evolved quite considerably with Harry's help. I mean, Harry and I talk about this all the time, over and over and over again, and both of us. We keep on getting a new picture of what do you do after these things show their limitations? What do you do? What do you do next? How do you think about it next? How do you go back? How do you look at it? This is the notion of inflammation, right? That inflammation influences diseases. Harry has a lot to say about this. That inflammation is a healthy response to everyday stress. That it's necessary for normal development. That in children, having inflammation that's followed by recovery increases the capacity to deal with inflammation the next time. And that in our lives, there will be periods when we will have inflammation, have disease. And the unhealthy response is you don't have enough recovery before the next episode. So if what happens is you have an inflammation and you don't have time to recover and you get another inflammation, then that's not a way to have development. That's a way that stops development. It's too much. And chronic inflammation results in increased risk of serious disease. And I think that there's good evidence for that. So there are questions about what the differences are between developmental and dangerous inflammation. And it may be that there are physiological measures for this, but there are lots of skeptics about that. So the idea is that order and disorder are part of in the interaction in the normal world, right? And that people confront both in the course of their lives. Their capacity to deal with stress and inflammation and illness is something that you want to develop. You want to be able to have people have that. Because you expect that there will be disorder. That a perfectly orderly life is dead. That's not possible. Okay. In fact, if your heart beats at the same time, at the same rate all the way through, you're going to die. You can't do that. Right? There has to be periods of chaotic. So the notion of smooth functioning then goes, and you have to start to think about it in different ways. And people began to think about this in earlier stages. But now we understand something about it. So you want to think about this notion of bounce-back ability that Harry has introduced. And it's distinct from control over your life, because it's actually being able to respond to periods of disorder in your life. So you can't reduce it to control over your life, which is one of the things that people try to do. Because we don't have control over some aspects of our life. We have to be able to take in crises and then respond to them. Okay? Periods of disorder. That the resources for health then, in Aristotelian theory, genetic structure is clearly a resource for recovery. But also how your individual identity develops. Your sense of self is a resource, right? This is one of the things that's emerging. People talk about confidence as being a resource for health. People talk about the fact that there are resources that one relates to in the outside world that one can count on as being part of self in that sense, that those aspects of self become very critical. So the notion of self as being interactive with the rest of the world and the way in which it's interactive would be one of the aspects of health that would come out of this. And then there are, of course, completely external resources like education, prosperity, or things that come way from the further outside. And then the environmental issues. But how we relate to our environment becomes another aspect of health in that way. I think that access to healthcare, by the way, is a very important resource for health, because what it does is it gives us confidence that if we were to become ill, and it's very possible that we will, that there would be resources that would help us when we were ill. So the notion that access to healthcare is irrelevant, or that healthcare itself is irrelevant to health, that some people make in health promotion, I think is a silly idea. Like Trevor Hancock. Right? Can you give a little shot at Trevor? So what are the policies that you have when you want to think about that? Well, the kinds of things that would work would be interventions that increase and strengthen people's resources to be able to deal with crises and instability, right? I mean, that's what follows from this. So what are those kinds of resources? That understanding that everybody's life is going to have some disorder in it, what allows you to respond to that better? What are those resources? It's interesting that if you can provide those resources, then you'll be doing something that will improve the health of the population as a whole and narrow the gap between the well-off and the poor. But there are policies that haven't worked well. So, for example, health education, interestingly, works well for some people, it doesn't for others. And what it seems to have done in some cases is to widen inequalities, benefit some groups differentially, like the people who are better educated benefit more from stop smoking campaigns than people who aren't. So your stop smoking campaign, the education campaign, has to be changed into another campaign that works in different ways, that provides different kinds of resources, say. So how do you do this? Well, it may be that this notion of increasing people's capacity to respond to life crises can include things like providing them with more resources that will, in general, give them a capacity to bounce back. So the kinds of things that Amartya Sen advocates, that you have bank loans available to everybody, for example. How do you do that? How do you spread that, providing economic support directly, allowing people to have more resources like that, providing more general education, providing, and so on. It may be that the results of these kinds of interventions are more testable. I think that we have a lot of work to do to try to understand what are the resources, what are the ways of intervening that allow for this to happen. I don't think that we have an answer. I think that this is the stuff that has to be studied. So if you take the fact that we need another picture of health, that we have to think about the policies that would augment it if we have this kind of picture of health, then there's a lot of work to be done, and the work is interesting, and there's a way of moving forward. So my feeling is that I'm very optimistic about this, because I think that people recognize the limitations of the old ways of thinking and are trying to think in new ways. And in the past few hours since coming here, we've begun to talk in that kind of way to try to see if we can get anywhere with it. But I'm not a guru. I don't have answers in that kind of way. What I do have is a different graphic for health. That there are other ways of thinking about it. And so that the boxes really aren't so clear, that the individual and the body isn't this clear, that the boxes are sort of blurry at the edges, and there's a lot more interaction than we think, and there's a lot more room for chaotic behavior. So instead of having boxes and arrows that are the old kinds of boxes and arrows, this is what I propose, that we have, that the different environments are open-ended, and we can't put them into boxes, that they interact with each other, and then they all interact with the individual in ways that are not so clear, and that together, all of these things together may result in bounce back ability. But then what happens, is that you have things that affect that come in from the outside that are not predictable, and then the question is what the capacity of that system is to respond. Okay. That's it. Thank you.
And for over 2,000 years, with just about every philosopher getting a name check on the way through. Questions? Comments? Phil?
Is there a link between your final idea and the biological idea of homeostasis, where the organism has this ability to maintain an internal environment and restore it against?
The Folker and Art. I think that that's right. I mean, it's good that you brought that. That's a very good question. I think that Folker and Art's idea, the homeostasis idea, is an important idea that's on the way to this. I think that, but that idea suggests that there are a series of mechanisms that create homeostasis, but I don't think they're mechanical. I think they're only mechanical. I think that the question about the influences on these, the bounce back ability stuff, isn't simply a homeostatic mechanism in the body, which bring you back to temperature, which bring your heart back to normal, and so on. It's not just that. It's questions.
It seems to me that there's an interaction between your idea and the idea of the hierarchy of systems, flaws, nested, and so on. Mm-hmm. What you're really asking is, what are the homeostatic, the regulated control mechanisms at higher levels?
That's right. It's what are the non-mechanistic homeostatic mechanisms? They're not just homeostatic. That's right. I mean, it's what is the complex analogy of homeostasis?
Exactly. There's an American neurologist who has coined the phrase allostasis for this, that instead of homeostasis returning things to normal, under stress you might return things to a different level, and that level may change depending on the level of stress that the organism is under. And he refers to that as and he's got an allostatic scoring system that he thinks predicts risk of breakdown of the system and so on. It's a combination of all of these ideas.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the presentation, but I think the way you really just scratch the surface, because we haven't talked about the philosophies of things like capitalism and socialism, and the issues which I think are really to the fore in our present time, which is basically about justice in society, and the fact that the inequality of health, to my mind, comes about from the absence of a just society. And if you look at the questions as they relate to health, if you look at the issues of global warming, that is, to my mind, the biggest barrier to health, because there's an awful lot of good policies. That, you know, you've had the World Health Organization back in the 80s, you've had a lot of policies, but what happens is those policies are not driven through, because the values aren't actually bought into, they're espoused, perhaps, by organizations, but they aren't driven through by those, whether they be political or pseudo-political in terms of hierarchies of health organizations, you know, etc.
I'm very skeptical about value-driven, purely value-driven health goals. I think that the best example we have of very powerful value-driven societies is the medieval Christian society, which is not a very good one in some way. So you have to be very careful when you think about that. I think the question is, the issue seems now, how do you have a diversity of values? And what does it mean to have society with diverse values, where people can live according to their values in much smaller groups, rather than have a single set of values that drives an entire society? That's very scary.
But is it not the case that if you look at, you know, you've got religion, you see Christian societies, values in your values, they didn't flow through, you know, the values system. I think if you take those intrinsic values down to ones that we, you know, thou shalt not kill, for example. Now, you would say, we don't write that through because why else would we in Iraq if we didn't, you know, didn't,
you're saying we're not living according to values. The question about whether you're living, the Americans are claiming they are living according to a very clear set of values. Right? I mean, that's the problem. The question is, I think that the issue is really the 17th century notion of tolerance that we're trying to build. I really think that the values business, as we know the play, that we really have to think about the circumstances that we're in, the kinds of things that are within our power to do, and recognizing that there are multiplicities of these things. I say to the left and to the right, I play on both their hands. I think that both of them have overplayed their hands.
One last question.
That's how I look at
it. If you were to look at the question of capitalism versus sustainability, like if you look at the agenda 21, etc., etc., then you have to see that you have to make a decision yourself to come down on that.
No, I don't think so. I think what I'm saying is that both capitalism, both extreme capitalism and extreme socialism are based on a mechanistic model. And they've come down to two opposite sides of how to work in a mechanistic model. I think that they're both the same. I think that the world doesn't work according to a mechanistic model. No parts of it do. Right? So having a strong, you know, so then the question is, how do you work that? How do we think that? And I think that we're not there. I don't think we understand how to work that and how we get beyond that kind of split. I think it's a big struggle. I don't have an answer, but I don't think that one or the other has an answer.
Over here.
Your presentation is very rich, and so I feel like I'm plodding very slowly behind. I wonder if you could talk more about almost your last slide about the shocks that come in as they relate to accountability. I'm just processing that.
Yeah,
for the first time in my mind, and I'll pose a question, and I'm sure you have the answer to it. It seems to me, as I thought about it, that a different size of shock was also related in a negative way to your ability to bounce back. What I mean is the inflammation that you talked about, or another example of a terrible shock, the tsunami, hit different nations. And what we heard quite quickly after it was certain nations saying we can bounce back from this. We don't actually need huge amounts of aid. And other places saying yes, we desperately need it. And it triggers in my mind that you have, if you're not careful, a kind of vicious circle where it doesn't take much of a shock. And it may relate a bit to what the gentleman was saying, that if you are in a deprived state,
I think when you talk about that, and I think about what you were saying, I think that one of the things that goes together is, I really admire the work of Amartya Sen when he talks about changing the difference that he makes between capacity and capability. That it's not just a matter of capacity, it's a matter of taking whatever resources you have and using them to turn it into capability. So that in some society, and the question about, and so differences in capacity, having a minimum amount of capacity will allow you to develop capability, is the thing that Sen talks about quite a lot. And I think that there's something really good about that, and that goes together with the argument for social justice. a different kind of argument for social justice that I think is really important.
But you, I can also see it. My wife's work for a while was in counselling the bereaved.
Yeah.
And the connection running through would be very familiar with about the increases of mortality, medical problems for a bereaved.
That's right.
That sense that suddenly you're nervous in terms of this different phrase that you come up with. And so it's quite unusual.
Yes, and I think that that there are a whole series of diseases that are associated with that and that go together with that. And then the question is, how do you build up people's capability to respond to these things? So it's not just resources, it's how the resources get used by the particular person in those circumstances at that time in order to develop the capability to respond. And so the example, I wasn't going to use the tsunami as an example, I was going to use the World Trade Center, the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York, where what's interesting about that is that was a shock that was not predicted, except of course by people like us who understand it. But the consequences of it were the health of many, many millions of people. Right? I mean, there were health consequences for many, many millions of people who came from completely outside the system. And then the question about the bounce back ability is quite various in the same way. The Americans haven't bounced back from it at all. I noticed today when I came to the airport here that you don't have to show a photo ID when you go through the airport security thing. That was something that was required until when? It was required everywhere. So there's less sense of the fear of terrorism than there is in Canada. In Canada, you have to show a photo ID when you go through office. So, and the whole issue about what the resources are and how those issues work out really depend upon individual society.
In Weatherhill, just now, there's a significant uprise in partly the 40-year-old men, and it's being attributed to their experiences 20 years ago as part of the entire that the stresses that these young men were under at that time, 20 years later, has precipitated this kind of...
I have a better one today. Better one in paper today, but Scottish men, about motor neurone disease among professional soccer players, football players, that comes from hitting the ball with your head. Right? Hey, you know, did you read the paper today? It's quite interesting. Different kind of stress.
Yeah.
So,
please
refer
to
the previous questions. I'm struggling to keep up, really. First of all, I think it's shameless that you're allowed Harry to get that phrase onto so many of the slides. I'll be noted in the minutes that was innocent of yours there. I think it was towards the end you began to talk about this notion of health and states of ill health as being related in some sophisticated and possibly more helpful way than we have tended to think of it. I think that's a very interesting line of argument. You also, earlier in your talk, when you were looking at these four different ways of viewing the world, ended up with a view where the pendulum had swung back and forth in the modern era. Now we've got this paradoxical acceptance of the coexistence of what might have been viewed as contradictory. And I think given that we're here, or you've been invited here because of the work of the Population Health Centre, there's this accepted statistic that Glasgow has the worst health anywhere on the planet. It's the only thing that we could win a world championship at is dying for variety of disorders. But if you scratch beneath that statistic, what you see is that some parts of Glasgow and its surrounding environment have the very best health in the country, and some parts have just truly awful health.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in the relationship from the point of view of the research centre between these areas of very good health and very good health. Is there anything in your view that might be functional about that disproportionate distribution of health resource across the city?
I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is the question that people should think about. It's what is the place of people who are marginalized in society? What benefit do they give to the people who aren't marginalized? Well, we haven't thought about that, and it's something to think about. So that's the hard thing to think about. So, in the same way as there is order and disorder, there are people who are largely part of society and people who are not, people who are less part of society. And that's been true for a very long time, and in different ways in different societies. think that one of the things about Glasgow is that Glasgow, that the health issues in Glasgow are not just Glaswegian issues, they're Scottish issues, and they're probably British issues. So the fact that there's somebody who's at the bottom of the league tables is important. And it's important to understand who it is and why they're there. We don't understand exactly why they're there, but it may be that there's a role that people play that has to be thought of. The thing, the example that I think that every country has its shame. I think that Canada's shame is the way we treat Aboriginal people. And we don't know how to get out of it. It's a puzzle. And we haven't thought about it as a puzzle in that way. We've thought about it as sort of, like, what can we do next? And every time we make an intervention, it doesn't seem to work. So, and the same thing is true in the United States with the black population. What do you do? And I think it's a real puzzle. And I think it's a puzzle that's worth really contemplating and thinking about in every which way, which we haven't done.
Jamie.
Sue, I've answered very much. Just the last couple of slides, I wanted to get some clarification on that. Are you just talking about the bounce back ability at an individual level, or can that be grouped up to a community level, or even a city-wide level? And are there features which you might have noticed that cities or areas facing similar difficulties react in different ways?
I think that that's absolutely right. I think that a lot of this stuff is holographic. I think that's what we were just talking about. It's that it may very well be that what you have is we have created in our societies clusters in our society where that bounce back ability isn't as strong as it is in others. And how have we done that? Why have we done that? What's the role of that? So, yes, I think that that's right. Yeah.
Phil,
then.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
What is the role of a sense of purpose and meaning in the capacity of development? You talked a lot about how we saw ourselves
and
got the sense of identity.
Yeah, I think
there's a lot bit today about how we've lost the sense of identity.
That's right.
Is that important in your mind?
I think so. I think that one of the things that we thought is that, and I think that one of the things about that is about the connection between people. That in the 1970s and 1980s, during the period that the existentialists were very influential. The notion is that this is entirely an individual thing. It was up to each of us as individuals to make our own world and to make our own value set and to decide what we wanted. Well, that's not the way we think about it now. We're beginning to think that it is the connection between people and how that works. I don't think we know enough about what that's about yet. And I do think that how we relate and how all of these factors come and fit together is what helps with this stuff. It helps us understand who we are. I think that we recognize more and more that who we are is not independent of where we're from and who we relate to and how we relate.
But it's not tribal or family.
No, it's not just tribal. That's right.
In the way
That's right. And the social scientists, and what the social scientists are coming up with is stuff that's sort of interesting, but not enough. So I have a friend who did a study on there's a questionnaire, a longitudinal questionnaire in Canada that about the health of children, and what a friend of mine does that sort of mines it to try to find stuff. And what she found was that children with behavioral problems in school don't have anyone that they're close to, don't have enough people that they're close to at an early age. So and if you have one person that you're close to at an early age, that would be enough to stop you from having reduced the incidence of behavioral problems at school for 5 to 8 year olds. For kids over 8, they have to have 2 to 3 people that they have a close relationship with that will reduce that risk. This is just doing correlations. So it suggests that there are relationship issues and the importance of relationships, not just familial ones, but certainly familial ones. Relationship with mother and father is very critical. But all of those things do have an impact on our resources, all our resources.
Yeah. I think it's just one thing that makes me slightly uncomfortable, and it's to caution against what I presume is, from my perspective, is an oversimplistic taking forward the logic of the bounce back ability. The thing that depends on what we've had to bounce back from.
Absolutely.
And I think the people in areas of deprivation who, maybe sitting here in a company who think they've actually got their conditioning people outcome to go back to a lot of things that are engaged in mental health.
Yes, but I think that what I'm saying is that what's very interesting is that when you talk about the level of stress of people who are in very high-powered positions, the level of stress among those people is extremely high. Right? But they do have a lot more capacity to deal with that stress because the stress isn't constant. It's not that it's not as great. That's what's interesting. It isn't constant. It isn't overwhelming. It doesn't overwhelm you all the time. So, for example, if you have a very, very large debt that you can't pay back, and you don't sleep nights but for many weeks at a time, that's a different kind of stress than having really, really stressful things to decide at work. It's a stress that wears you down and grinds you down. If you don't know whether you're going to pay the rent or not, it's a different kind of stress, right? It's a stress
that's constant. Far higher level of stress, and that's what...
I don't know if it's a higher level of stress. It may be that it's an all-consuming level of stress, right? It's different nature almost. I think that that's right. I think what you're saying is absolutely right. However, one of the things that's also the case is that's in Harry's, in some of Harry's work, is that children of people who are well off have higher levels of stress when they're young, that they're stressed more, they're challenged more, and the consequence of that is that it builds up their capacity to deal with certain kinds of stresses, whereas other children don't.
Yeah, I think it's just the balance.
That's right.
I don't mean to oversimplify.
I don't mean to discount the difficulties. I'm saying that the question is what, and so the policy issue is what are the resources that we can put in place that stops that from happening? And I don't think prepares people more for the stresses of everyday life, not for the kinds of stresses that you're talking about. I think that you're quite right. You want to get rid of the big stresses, so you want to make sure that that's why I say that having a publicly funded healthcare system is a very critical determinant of health.
I think we should wind up at this point, and I'd like to ask Carol Craig to come and give us her response to the ideas that Chulam has advanced.
To accept the poison chalice. If people were saying, oh my God, I don't know that I can follow that, and I get enough to respond to this very erudite lecture. I would like to say a couple of things, though. One of the things that really struck me from what you were saying, I found it fascinating tread over those times of looking at different ways of seeing the world. I was very struck by the fact I don't think one woman was mentioned during it. It's such a real aspect of the world. And you just said, if women had been part of that, we would have constructed the world in that way. I mean, it was only towards the end that we started to talk about relationships, and we would have seen it in terms of I was also very, very aware, because I've done a lot of work on personality type, that this is not just one group of men's way of seeing the world, but a particular personality type's view of looking at the world, and it's not how the majority see it. Now, I am of that type of personality myself. I like abstract ideas, I like logic, and it's like it's as if there's a Rubik's Cube, and you get a bit of logic, you get a bit of an insight, and you continue to turn around. That's not how the masses see the world. That is a kind of minority I was very aware that there's nothing in this about diversity or difference or whatever. Another point was, I mean, I know you're looking at, you know, the West and Western philosophy because that's what we were shaped by, but I was also aware that Eastern philosophies would have a very, very different view of the world, and maybe a view of the world that is much, much more conducive to good health, because we don't see it in that mechanistic way. A second point, this was partly because I had a voice in my head saying, what if you led yourself? Which got me to thinking about it, and in a way, I suppose it's the kind of psychology that I've been quite interested in, and I've read quite a lot of some of the recent work in the brain, which says, you know, we really are fundamentally animals. We are animals who are very alert to fear and danger because that's what keeps us alive. And, you know, our brain kind of seeks out negativity all the time in lots of ways. And that there is a sort of negative self-talk that seems to be pretty prevalent across cultures. That people have a voice in their head that says negative things to them a lot of the time. And you know, some of the psychologists like Csikszentmihalyi and others are saying there's a lot of research to show that left to its own devices, the brain becomes negative. You know, actually negative thinking is a very, very important and easy thing for human beings to do. And again, going back to Eastern philosophy and religion, religions, a lot of their training is actually about trying to get on top of that, so that your conditioning your behavior will not allow you to be driven by these quite negative animal impulses in lots of ways. So how does this relate to the last point of the discussion? And I think that, you know, a lot of the work in positive psychology, like the Seligman, and Csikszentmihalyi and others, is pointing out that you're saying resilience is a hugely important issue, and that the people often who are likely to have the best health are the ones who are managing a better level of positive self-talk a lot of the time, not kind of positive thinking of that horrible American variety, but something that is more kind of realistic, that a lot of the time what we're really, really pessimistic about doesn't come to pass, that there's actually ways in which we can realise that the big dangers that we think are out there are not as bad as we think. And I think a lot of the people who survive poverty or, you know, were to go to some of the really brutal schemes, there are still people who are living there who've actually got reasonable health and relationships or whatever. And if you looked at it, it's probably because what's going on inside their head is actually better in many ways than for the people who get there. So I think we have to look as well at this negativity and positivity in that context. So I'm glad I didn't want to say that.
Thank you very much, Carol. Before winding up, we have some refreshments. Where are they? Just through the back, through next door. I'd just like to finish by thanking Shalom for coming here. It's his second trip to Glasgow this year, and becoming a regular. And Carol for her thoughts, and also everyone who contributed to this discussion, and you all, in fact, for coming along on a cold night. Thanks very much. Our next meeting, our next talk is Richard Layard on the 5th of April, venue to be confirmed. Those of you who want to read about Richard Layard, if you go down to W.H. Smith's and get this week's prospect, he's got the front page article on happiness. It's a read that brings a smile to your face. So look forward to seeing you on the 5th of April. Please join us for some refreshments. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
Yeah.
It's on in my document, so you can just put it in.
We'll get Jenny to
Did you get it off?
No, there's one already in here.
Yeah, take it out, that's mine.
That was like you were
trying. Yeah, in.
I need to email this across to you.
That'd be great.
Yeah, and you can have it.
To be honest, it's
but I can send you. I'll send you the paper. I mean,
I'd love the paper. The purpose for asking for some of these slides is because I'm teaching a strategy course next week, and I quite like that from a class course.
Yeah,
the strategy is always kind of like, if I just had more data, man, I'd solve this problem.
Yeah, exactly. That's the.
So it's for another purpose.
But it's all so deep in us, that Laplacian idea. I think that if people don't get how important, how it sort of sits in your head. And,
I'd like to talk about the possibility of practical philosophy as what ties up practical positivity.
This is my email address.
Great, thank you. Talk about practical philosophy and how that improves health or has the potential to improve health. I'm hoping to do a project with early dementia sufferers to see if it helps. But I'm trying to start up a centre for philosophy and education at the moment. It's
Applied really?
University, so I just think that there's...
Yeah, there's something in there, of course.
Yeah, and Mark and I at the moment, I've got a bid in asking for some money to do some...
To do that.
...philosophy to...
Do you know Nigel Laurie?
I know the name, but I don't know.
Because he does philosophy and management.
Yeah.
And he's interested in this stuff. So...
Okay.
Yeah, but sure. Yeah, I'm interested in it too. Very interested in it. Yeah, good luck. Good luck.
Thank
you. Hi there, nice to meet you. Yeah, nice to meet you. Thank you for your question.
Well, it's...
I think we need new conceptions of social justice.
We
really need.
Yeah. I haven't got a religious vibe or anything. I come from a kind of religious background. But what interests me is that I think the whole idea of diversity, etc., etc., everything's value based. Do you know what I mean? The whole idea of education, do you know what I mean, comes from a sense of values.
Absolutely. The question is, the issue is, I mean, I think that what happens is that people assume that you're going to be able to have a shared value that's going to drive everybody together.
Uh-huh.
And my sense is we don't.
Yeah.
And that trying to do that, it ends up being a kind of totalitarian in one way or another. And I think that that's wrong. I think that we have that the possibility of having people work with multiple values and have... The way I talk about it is, what you want is a shared agenda, not shared values.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way to
talk. Well, maybe it's just the terminology there, because, I think we're coming to the same place there, because what I'm thinking
we don't want to have this kind of poverty and ill health.
Exactly.
That's what we agree on. Then the question is, how do we do it?
Exactly.
And I agree with you.
Yeah.
That's great stuff. Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Why?